Welcome to the Volterra podcast number 14. In case you didn't realize, that was Ben Trekinger. He's back. How are we doing today, Ben?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back, Ron. It's good to be back.
Good to hear. Good to hear. He was on deadline last week, so he wasn't able to join us. And as always, Louis Reeve. How are we doing today, Louis?
We're good. I was on deadbeat last week, so I'm able to join you again. There we go.
I think Ben was just going to sell us something. We were just talking about the reason Ben wasn't here was, like, as I said, he was on assignment, not on assignment, but on deadline. And you've submitted a couple pieces recently, Ben?
I have. I don't want to blow the. I don't want to sort of like give away the. I don't know what the phrase is. I don't want to say too much about exactly what the subject of the story is. One of them is a piece about a journalist who believes that there is some sort of government cover-up related to the Boston bombing, and has been very critical of official accounts, thinks that there's more to the story that the government isn't telling us. And has even gone so far as to suggest, without quite endorsing the idea that the bombing may have been a false flag operation by elements within the American state to sort of justify the Homeland Security complex, sort of compared it to the Reichstag fire in Germany or those apartment bombings in Moscow in the 90s in terms of a historical precedent for something like that.
Yeah, and that kind of touches on what we wanted to talk about in general today was the militarism, the growing military. Well, it already exists, the existing militarism in American society and the growing militarism in British society. And Louis had brought this up as the topic that you wanted to talk about in reference to the how many poppies were outside the Tower of London, Lou?
I'm unsure of the exact amount of poppies, but the several thousand, possibly hundreds of thousands.
Several hundred thousand.
Yeah, I believe so. It's quite a large surface area they've got to cover with such a small ceramic flower. So I'd say in the hundreds of thousands there easily. Yeah.
Why don't you give us a little background about what the poppy is and
like Flanders Fields poppies?
Correct.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you guys do it in America. I know they probably do it in Canada, but probably not in America. Basically, due to the symbolism of the Flanders Field poppies, people in Britain buy replica poppies and wear them up to Remembrance Day, which was 3 days ago, so the 11th of November, when the guns stopped in theory. On the Western Front, they stopped. They carried on in several other theaters of war, but we tend to forget them. Anyway, as part of the celebrations, I'm not sure is the right word, but the part of the whole spiel this year is that they've built an entire field of ceramic poppies outside the Tower of London in London, which is a sight to behold if you're into ceramic flowers and medieval fortifications. Is second to none, really, in that case.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's come to represent more than just the World War One dead, right?
Yeah, this is why I thought it'd be quite interesting subject to bring up. The last veteran of World War One, I believe, died in something like quite recently, but about two, three years ago.
Yeah.
I think there's now no. I mean, there's looking at it logically, anyone that had fought in World War One has got to be over 100 years old by quite a distance now. Even if you did lie about your age and fought in only 1918, you're still looking at the best part of 100 years. So most people are dead. In fact, they are now statistically
110,
all
112. Like that's how old you'd have to be to have been a reasonable age. Like you, yeah.
A minimum. Yeah, absolutely. And they are all dead now. There is now no longer any veterans. And I believe the poppy appeal was kind of started as this thing that it was due to the fact that there was like little provision made for the vast slaughter and maiming that the First World War created. So they sold poppies in order to try and raise money for people with no legs and that sort of thing, or people that had had their hands blown off by hand grenades and that kind of thing. Anyway, now I just get this feeling it's sort of losing a lot of its meaning. We use it a lot for these more recent wars that Britain's been involved in, especially in the Middle East, which I sort of feel that it's not really the same concept of war. There's no longer even a conscript army. It's people that do this as a job that have gone out to Afghanistan completely voluntarily, and they've been injured or they've been maimed, but I don't think that's within. It shouldn't be part of the sort of remembrance psyche, so to speak.
Yeah.
As much as World War One and Two to an extent should be as well. But I found the government here as well has kind of got quite behind this whole. They do this every year, but this year particularly because we're trying to vote ourselves out of the EU. So they've been using the kind of us against them thing, and it's obviously the Germans being the like major power in the EU. They're like, there's all this like weird language going around, like the, you know, making a stand, and we need to, as Britain, stand up to the powers that have been in Europe, and it's quite pathetic really, and is very dated, and I just wondered what your opinion on the whole thing was from a US perspective anyway.
Well, your opinion about trying to draw a stark contrast between the war dead of conscript wars, World War One, World War Two, and like the professional armies of today, would be hugely scandalous in the United States. People would go crazy and tear your face off if you said that in the U.S. That's really that here is really goes against sort of like a deeply ingrained reverence for combat troops that draws no distinction, wouldn't even want to contemplate a distinction between conscripts and the professional soldiers that do it today.
Yeah.
I don't know where I stand, but I can tell you that in the U.S. that's a
anathema,
bombshell to drop.
Yeah. To Louis's point about it kind of growing in it not just being about World War One anymore. There was there's an Irish footballer named Phelan McLean or something like that, and he plays for Wigan. Louis, I was just talking about the Irish footballer, somebody named McLean.
James McLean, yeah, he plays for Sunderland now, yeah.
Oh, does he? I thought he was Wigan, but
he moved in the summer, yeah.
Okay, but he is protesting. He's not wearing a poppy on his shirt, and he's like he's been booed. He's been kind of there's been a lot of criticism of him.
Sure. Ostracized.
And ostracized, yes. And he wrote a very eloquent letter to the chairman of his club, saying how if you want to talk about the soldiers that die in World War One, okay, that's great. A lot of British soldiers, including Irish soldiers, and he's a Republic of Ireland, but he's from Northern Ireland.
It's complicated, yeah.
Yeah, he what's that?
Is he Catholic or Protestant?
He's Catholic. So his point is that the poppies have come to represent all the wars that Britain has fought, including the troubles in which British soldiers occupied Northern Ireland and occupied his town. He's from Derry, where Bloody Sunday was, and he can't commemorate those soldiers, he'd be going against his hometown, his people, blah, blah, blah. Which I thought it was very eloquently written, very, very well articulated argument. But it's to the larger point of kind of, hey, wait a second. We can, and this is kind of touching on what you said, Ben, we can support our veterans and not agree with the wars that they fight in. And often those two are like inextricably linked.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely on this footballer side of like, I'm not fucking commemorating anyone that came into my hometown and killed people, you know?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think McLean has a very good point. Yeah.
So more to this, more to the kind of militarization of society. Ben, have you? I mean, we've been alive over the past. We've kind of come of age, rather, over the past decade and a half or so, 15 years, that America has undergone this massive militarization since 9/11. And I'm just wondering what your take on it is, how you view it, because obviously you're not the normal kind of uncritical American, but
yeah, I mean, I think that it's largely unnecessary. It was largely a knee-jerk reaction born out of fear, and people who are afraid tend not to make good decisions. They tend not to make decisions that hold up well in scrutiny. Hold up well to scrutiny a long time later. I think that, you know, we more or less live in a safer world than there's ever been. You know, I suppose the exception, what has actually changed, like the one aspect of our world that is perhaps more dangerous is the ability of a single person or a small group of people to do more damage, to kill more people than they really realistically could have before, 50, 100 years ago, with bombs, you know, especially if they were to have a thermonuclear device. And so I think that, you know, that if you have a very thoughtful approach to that specific new threat and sort of savvy ways to counter that threat, there are changes you can make, but sort of this mass militarization, mass beefing up of security, that is not warranted. And of course the wars that we've gotten ourselves into, as part of the same sort of response to this terrorist attack, none of it holds up to scrutiny. It's definitely a disturbing trend, and I think that it has the potential to get worse at this point because largely it's been – well, foreign wars are always terrible, but I mean worse for Americans in their everyday lives because of the militarization of police departments, which has been – you know, New York, obviously it happened very quickly. Some of the major police departments, it happened very quickly. But now it's sort of trickling down to places like Ferguson, to places like Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's just disturbing. You do not want police, and they want these gadgets, and they want these big guns, but they shouldn't have them. So I'm disturbed by it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Louis, what's your kind of view? I mean, my experience in the UK has been that the British public is increasingly following Americans' lead in kind of this militarism, in this. The military as an everyday aspect of people's lives, even when we're not technically at war, have you seen this kind of militarization at all in the UK?
It's quite prevalent in that it's quite easy, like, to join the army is still seen as it's an easy way to kind of. To live your life, if you want to go in as a soldier or a sailor, whatever, join any of the armed services. What I think's kind of changed is people have started to equate the idea of the army sort of following on with what Ben was saying, is they equate the idea of the army as being like safety, like protection, national protection, which. It isn't. We have other things for to serve against enemies of the state, enemies of terrorists, effectively, or or anyone trying to, you know, do harm on British soil, but people kind of equate it with the army. And we do have quite a large army, and we are involved with wars, which people in countries where people sort of assume terrorism is sort of born from. This, I think, basically gives people this unrealistic opinion of the military, of the army, of the navy, of the air force, which, though not unessential, is, I would say, a dated concept in certainly the psyche that we have here in the UK. But it's part of our culture, it's part of our history, and it's almost inextricable from that every time we had an empire, it was maintained by a strong military. We fought off we came out tops on two world wars. We've defended British soil even against people like, you know, the Argentinians in the South Atlantic. It's ridiculous. But people get on the bandwagon once they're, you know, it's the sort of football mentality almost, where people kind of get behind the team and it suddenly all kind of comes together. Another thing as well, which is a bit weird, is the army is actually one of the is a big employer in the UK. It is people that work for the military in whatever capacity it is actually a very it's a significant percentage anyway. So there's that to consider as well.
Yeah. So this kind of that what you just said kind of touches on two points that I wanted to make. First, it's really easy to make an argument or to not to make an argument, but to support soldiers. Like it's really easy to get on that bandwagon, at least in the US. And I think this is becoming a trend in the UK as well. Corporations have begun to hop on this bandwagon and have become this kind of hero worshiping, movement, behind like the support our troops movement. And a lot of it is, I hesitate to really denigrate it, because a lot our veterans do need a lot of help. They're not supported by our government very well.
No, I agree here as well. Yeah, like right. Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's corporations trying to advertise to people. And last September I wrote a blog about, or I wrote a post or an article about the NFL and militarization that's on the Volterra. And I was basically saying how the NFL has grown up with the militarization of the American public. All these companies have kind of thrown in their lots with it, and it's all of a sudden it's expected that people will will kowtow to the militarism and kowtow to the support of the troops movement. And I think a lot of this, the reason I say corporations are involved in this is because a lot of these corporations are subsidiaries or related or making money from companies that are involved in the military industrial complex. And like that's a direct link from companies like Halliburton, companies like Lockheed Martin, companies like Boeing, straight on down the line to companies like Bank of America and USAA and all these other multinational and domestic corporations that are manipulating the sentiments of the American public for their profit. Any comments?
No, I think you've touched on, yeah, it's a pretty grim circle.
I'll just say I was sitting in a little sort of like diner in Maine on Sunday, and the football game was on, some football game was on, and they started showing this montage at the beginning of the game that was all like images of like soldiers in football stadiums, and then just like soldiers, and then just like football stadiums. It's like, what the, our jaws all sort of dropped, and we're like, what the hell is going on here? And then we remembered it was Veterans Day, but which, you know, sort of is a context in which that montage makes a little more sense. But I think it's a little telling that we all you know, having just not really been like, oh yeah, it's Veterans Day tomorrow or in a couple of days, of course. We're all just like, is this just like a standard NFL propaganda video that they just play at any time? And well, like, what? Well, there's like a group of us, a pretty diverse group of people, a couple of friends from like Ohio. And we all, that was all our sort of first thought. And we were all like, what?
There was one of those. Pepsi made a commercial that was literally military, cut kids and family, cut football, cut Pepsi, cut military families, cut football, cut. Yeah, and it was like, it was this kind of like piano in the background. It was literally disgusting. And Pepsi is, this was a random commercial. This was a random commercial for the beginning.
We're just like,
what's up?
Soldiers, football, family, and Pepsi.
Yeah, exactly. It was linking, it was trying to link Pepsi into this greater narrative of how football is American and Americans go and fight wars and Pepsi is a part of that, like, push. And of course, Pepsi has also owns Pizza Hut and Frito-Lay and all these other company and all these other restaurants that Baskin Robbins, I think, that build restaurants in war zones in the green zone in Iraq and in I'm sure in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah, Frito-Lay may be in K rations. I'm not sure.
In where?
In rations. In rations.
Oh, rations. Yeah. Probably. Frito-Lay is evil. I'm in Monsanto. So, okay, we can bitch about this as much as we want, because it is, and we sound like a bunch of like 20-year-old pricks, which we are. But
well, I'm 25.
Well, I'm 25 too. 20-something-year-old, excuse me, 20-something-year-old.
Thanks for the categorize, at least that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, but does our generation change this, or does this kind of play itself out over the next several decades as the continuation of the Romanization of the kind of Atlantic empire?
I personally think we're kind of fucked, actually. Like, I mean, I'd say my views actually in a pretty significant minority, even in Britain, which isn't as militarized as the USA. It's sort of, ignorance is the wrong word, but, it's impossible to make this point to anyone, you know, to say that, like, no, like, there's a point that we need to draw the line. It's 100 years ago that we're still remembering the same war. This 100 years is an incredibly long time. Like, the entire spectrum of just the world has changed immeasurably in said period. And the fact that we still equate one thing with something that you can, you know, vaguely relate it to today is just irrelevant. But most people my age, British people, they are well on the bandwagon. They think it's a worthy cause, you know, and great. I actually got to go out with the UK and US kind of viewpoint. My girlfriend, who's Danish, who they haven't fought a war since 1864, where they got royally shat on by the Prussians. she was amazed. She didn't, when she first came over here, about the poppy appeal, which is really prevalent in the UK. Like, everybody wears one. I mean,
I wore one when I was there.
Yeah, I used to wear one, like, absolutely, like, it was a matter of course. But she didn't understand what it was, and I explained that it's for war, and she thought that was ridiculous, the amount of money that they're spending on remembering, well, what it's supposed to remember is, or what it's, you know, the symbolism is supposed to remember, veterans of the First World War. Now it's kind of snowballed a bit, but she was amazed that, like, we don't spend this money on a more worthwhile or relevant cause. And I thought that was a very refreshing point of view. Though, if you are from Denmark, you haven't. I mean, yes, they were occupied during the Second World War, and they maintained neutrality in the First World War. They don't have a full kind of. They don't have the same historical experiences here. But it was. I thought it was a pretty relevant point. There's a, you know, there's better ways that you could sort of distribute this money anyway.
Yeah, Ben, you were gonna say something.
Yeah, I think actually that militarism in Atlantic society is on the decline. I think that, you know, in most of Europe, it's been happening for a long time. I think that the U.S., a lot of broader cultural trends, like really broad, like fundamental trends, just tend to hit Europe first, and then the U.S. is just a little behind on things like that. I think that the Pentagon has realized basically that they can't have – I think since Vietnam, basically, I think that was a turning point where the Pentagon realized that they can't count on a uniformly militarized society. That's where it really broke into two, and there was about half of society in America was like still on board with this whole project, and about half became anti-war, and a lot of them became radicalized. And I think ever since then, the Pentagon has sort of realized what's happening. You know, in a globalized world, it's just much harder to say, let's kill these fucking Huns, let's kill these fucking Japs, they're subhuman, you know, and really get people into that mentality, which is why so much has been invested in drones, right? You're not going to get people to go out and risk their lives as easily. The public's not going to support troops on the ground. Okay, let's make drones, let's make robots. The future's going to be in things like cyber warfare. So I think that in terms of sort of like the raw militarism present in society, it's to me pretty clearly the long-term trend is towards a decline. And the question, I think, for the military apparatus is just to how to continue to wage war, given that they're not going to be able to really fundamentally reverse that decline.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, so they're finding technological solutions.
Yeah. So I'm going to kind of hedge between you two. I don't think the militarism in the American consciousness is going anywhere anytime soon. I think it's not just militarism. I mean, that's a symptom of a greater kind of psyche within the American public that has a lot more to do with we're number one, USA, 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 America, America, like that kind of ideology. Which is more patriotism than militarism, and they're often, I think right now they're linked. I think the greater issue with the US is that we haven't really come to any sort of closure with mistakes we've made in our past. And we've kind of, so you were talking about the Pentagon post Vietnam. We for a little bit, I actually had this discussion with somebody yesterday. He was saying how Americans and Germans have both come to accept the mistakes of their past. And I absolutely agreed with the fact that the Germans have, but the Americans absolutely have not. And he
not uniformly.
What's that?
Not uniformly.
Not uniformly.
Divided so, society.
Yeah. So and he cited Apocalypse Now and Platoon as films that kind of show the dark side of Vietnam. And I was like, yeah, okay, to a point, but in the whole reason Reagan got elected was because of the malaise of the mid 1970s that was caused by the subtle realization in the American public that we really fucked up and in Vietnam and we need to kind of reconcile this on a greater scale, and that was coming into kind of conjunction with recognizing what we did to the Indians and going all the way back to the genocide or Holocaust, whatever you want to call it, of Native American populations. I know I'm going on a little bit of a tangent here, but these are mistakes that that American society has made over its history, and the conservative movement in the U.S. has continually claimed that the past is where our greatness is, rather than where the past is what is something we need to learn from. And I mean, when 50% of the American public votes, over 50% of the American public votes conservative and votes to support these kind of values, I guess you call them values of restoring America to its greatness. Then we have a larger issue than simple militarism.
So One, a quick story that sort of speaks to your broader point. This guy, Ted Widmer, I know, who was a speechwriter for Clinton, a foreign policy speechwriter, went with him on a trip to Africa in Clinton's second administration. And Clinton was going to some island in West Africa that had been like sort of like a hub of the slave trade, a place where like voyages across the Atlantic, had their last call near the African mainland. And
slavery was the other large societal mistake that we made in inclusion, including the Indians. That was the one I was forgetting. Sorry, go ahead.
And Ted wrote, I guess this, some really eloquent speech that I think basically apologized for slavery. And it got axed at the last minute because the concern just became that the Republicans back home were going to, he had gone to Rwanda and apologized to them for not preventing the genocide, which Clinton considers the biggest mistake of his presidency. And so Widmer had written this speech for slavery too, and they were, basically, so the Republicans were going to slam them for going on some apology tour abroad and looking weak and all this stuff. So the thing got axed. So yeah, that just sort of speaks to like this. There actually is like an active energy preventing the country from coming to terms with the crimes in its past. But in terms of how that relates to militarism, I would also just say like, yeah, Reagan definitely rode on this wave of we're not going to apologize for being American and the Soviet Empire is evil. But then if you look at his actual strategy in the Cold War, it was a lot of, it was like proxy wars that were abetted by covert CIA ops in Central America. It was this threat of building Star Wars, of building a missile shield. It was huge investments in military spending. And it was a lot of rhetoric. But it was also a consumer society in the United States. So I think that Reagan sort of paved the way post-Vietnam for how we can continue to sort of wage a kind of war and have a military that we're prioritizing while also coming to terms with or even encouraging a less militarized society. Because I think the 80s was not marked by militarism. It was marked by consumerism, and that was also Reagan's doing.
I disagree to a point with that. I mean, in the 80s, you saw movies like Red Dawn. You saw a lot of
– a movie. I mean, you had a
– But, I mean, that's about war.
You can find any decade where you have movies like that, you know?
Okay. But you I mean, you had American Gladiators. You had – I mean the list of American first like militarism, like actual masculine kind of like masculine military, I don't know, culture in the 80s, I think was very present. I would disagree with you.
Look at American Gladiators. It's like these guys with long hair beating each other's brains out. It seems like that's almost indicative of like taking what would be, you know, just like look at like MMA versus American Gladiators. American Gladiators was more like showy and entertainment, and MMA is like just fighting. I'm not going to say that that's not a sign of some sort of militaristic strain, but I'd say that the real story of the 80s is not any sort of return of militarism to mainstream society. It's consumerism.
I mean, I think they're linked. I think
you can't really have a strong consumerist surge. I think if anything, that sort of makes it harder to have a militaristic surge at the same time, because I think that they're so decoupled.
I disagree with that. I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all. Louis, what's your kick in your opinion?
Obviously, I don't know. In the way that like the, I mean you're both gone at it from a completely American point of view. So I'm really all at sea on that.
Throwing the British one. Yeah. or the European.
But yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I don't know, to be quite frank with you.
Oh, that's fair. Ben, I didn't mean to take the last word from you there. If you you want to ask?
That's cool.
Okay. Yeah, you have any words? What's that? I was just wondering if you were
getting very militaristic over here.
Yeah, exactly. Cut you off.
Yeah, of course, you're in Europe now. You like start thinking liberally and stuff. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I've never been known for a liberal tent before coming.
But yeah, where are you right now, Rowan?
I'm in the Netherlands. I'm at my girlfriend's grandmother's house in the Netherlands.
Oh, nice. I like the little painting thing behind you.
It's a Chinese guy.
Whoa, that's not what I was expecting when you moved that frame at all.
Yeah.
Dude, that was like a visual illusion or something.
No, it's a little creepy. No, she's super Buddhist. So for those of you, those of you listening and not able to see, the house is covered in like Buddhism and Buddhas and candles and like water. She's not here. She's actually in India right now celebrating Buddhism. But okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, that's a good chat on that. Before we go, Lou, we were talking. I know Ben isn't a football fan, but he might appreciate this. We got a Scotland v Ireland tonight in the Europa or UEFA.
Whatever it's even called, they're calling it the Euros anyway.
Euros, yeah.
Yeah.
It's and this is the Rowan Kane Cup. This is I am Scotch Irish almost entirely.
You've hedged your bets there, mate. Like you're.
I'm an Irish fan, very much. But what's your take on the game tonight?
Well, me, stop him, man. But yeah, obviously, that's slightly impartial. Hopefully, we'll the Scotland Ireland conundrum is a bit iffy in that like there is a couple of the Irish players are Scottish and playing for Ireland due to the fact that our countries are fairly inextricably linked, you know. There's a bunch of injuries. I have actually had a few beers. Like I'm pretty nervous about this one today, but we'll hopefully it got. Like if we win, it's actually quite big. Ben, for like the non-football fan, it's quite hard to explain, but Scotland is, I think, probably the country that likes sport the most without being that good at it. Makes sense. Like we haven't qualified for a major tournament since 1998. Okay. So it's really fucking like the hurt's been going for like a really long time. So it was when I was like quite a young child. And now we actually have quite a good team, but we're in a very hard group. And one of them is like the Irish, like the old, one of the major rivals anyway. And we've got a half chance. So if we win tonight, we're actually going to be top of the group. Like we've got a really good chance of being involved with a major tournament for the first time since 1998, which is, as you say, a very long, you know, we're getting to you know, you're way over a day. Yeah.
Deal with Germany and Poland, which is another fascinating rivalry in the same group.
Exactly. It's exciting football. And I hope, fingers crossed, we will prevail tonight. That's okay.
Where are you going to be watching it?
Somewhere around here. It's always a bit difficult in London because there's most places it's English, but then anywhere that isn't English will almost certainly be Irish. They're only used to. Yeah. I mean, Scottish culture in London is pretty low. Actually, we can do a bit on this like on another episode, but. Yeah, there was one Scottish pub which is shut down, which is good because it was horrible. But that would have been the place to watch it. But now I'll have to find somewhere else that isn't like predominantly Irish, and that'll be fine.
If the Ironies go any further, they're playing at Celtic Park tonight, so that's just one more little. Let's see.
2-1 Scotland.
What about you, Rowan? What's your prediction?
I think it's going to be 1-1. I think it's going to be 1-1 draw.
It wouldn't be the worst result ever, but a win would be brilliant. Yeah.
I think these teams have struggled for too long for either of them to actually succeed. And because if Ireland wins, that means they're almost through. They just need to pick up like a couple more points over the next few games.
Yeah.
So we've got Louis thinks Scotland. I think draw. What's your prediction?
I think it's very informed. 1-0 Ireland.
1-0 Ireland. That's right. You spent time in Ireland, so yeah.
Yeah. Hey, we covered all the bases here.
What's that?
You covered all the bases here. We're good.
Yeah. Someone on this podcast can be at least a little bit right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a wrap up for the week. Follow me at RLM Kane. Follow the Volterra at the Volterra. Follow Ben at
Shrek Reports, SCHRECK Reports.
And follow Louis at
just any street corner on the Central Line in London would be fine. I can wander past me. I know where to go. It's perfect. Or if you're digitally minded, it's Deep Fried Fiddle. At Deep Fried Fiddle for all your Scottish insight in the heart of London. That's me.
All right. I'll talk to you next week.
Gents, it's been a pleasure. I'll see you next time.
Hasta luego. Well, come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of